So now, okay, we are officially recording. Welcome to Talk Mental Health with Logan Noon. I am talking with Jess, also known as B, also known as Bipolar Barbie online. And I've followed your page now for I don't even know how many years. You're super public about your bipolar disorder and other mental health conditions that you live with. And it's super inspirational and cool that you're so open. And yeah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
And I think you must get the award for furthest guest away, because where are you talking to me from?
Australia.
That's awesome. So what time is it there?
It's like 7:30 in the morning.
Damn. Commitment to the show. I do not even have that own commitment to my own podcast. It is 12:30 where I am talking to you from in the afternoon in good old Yakima, Washington. I've never been to Australia, but pretty cool, and it's awesome that we can connect continents apart and talk about mental health.
I know, it's crazy, and I actually think that's a good lead-in to mental health. Like, being a mental health advocate online is like a really interesting niche, and I think mental health gets a really bad rap online, particularly in social media. Which I get that if you're looking at like the Kardashians of the world, you know. Mm-hmm. But I also think it's a great way to connect with so many people. Like, isolation is a really huge issue with people with like depression, anxiety, and a lot of mental health issues. So being able to connect in an online format like this, like face-to-face chat or interact with people in that regard, is sort of like bridging that gap of isolation. No matter where you are in the world, it's not so much about finding people in your like, you know, immediate community that can relate to you, which is often hard. It's like, once you've got that whole world of ocean out there, you know, like, it's easier to kind of fish for those people that really can relate to you and understand what you're going through.
Yeah. And being an advocate myself, I've been able to have conversations with people that I never would have ever interacted with in a million years. Like, I just did a podcast episode called Ask Me Anything, and I had a couple questions from Iran and from Chile. And if I wasn't an advocate, like, I never would have had those kind of interactions. So it's really led to kind of this very interesting, unique, beautiful experience being publicly open about my bipolar disorder. So I guess let's give a, so you host like a YouTube channel, Instagram. I know you do like a million things. Can you give the listener at least an idea of all the things that you're contributing to the mental health community right now?
Yeah, well, I do a lot. Like, obviously, I've got all of my social media, you know, Bipolar Barbie, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. I've also got my YouTube channel, which I love because, like, people really like my writing, but I never really considered myself a writer. I was always like a public speaker. So, you know, the video format is probably what I prefer. I do motivational speakers as well in my local community. That's something I've been doing for a really long time, even before I had something of substance to say.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, I do that kind of stuff. Like, I guess the long-term plan, I'm working on some books as well. So the Bipolar Barbie Diaries, which is just really in-depth. It's like a 10-volume series of just sort of like my private diaries turned into a book, which really show you what it's like on a day-by-day basis to really be struggling with this. And, you know, that's not a summary. That's like, I'm sitting in a doctor's surgery today and I am waiting again for an hour and a half for like a $300 appointment that I just really can't afford right now. Like, you know, stuff like that. So I'm doing that as well. I actually have like a sassy t-shirt company called Attitude Apparel.
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause people always ask, I don't even have one of my t-shirts I'm representing right now, but, I know, shame, but, so I'm doing that attitudeapparel.com.au. And, I'm running a support group at the moment. I'm running a few, actually. I'm running a support group online, which is kind of like a mastermind of, like, I've got a bunch of strong women that are a part of this group. And it's all about personal development. It's all about learning to live with your mental health or, your mental illness disorders. And it's like, you know, people who have dreams, like, we all have dreams, and I don't want mental illness to get in the way of that. Like, I want to be able to work. I want to be able to contribute to society, but it's so hard, I think, to do that when you're struggling with any form of illness or any form of setback in your life. Mental illness, I guess, just happens to have a lot of them. It deteriorates your physical health. It deteriorates your, like, finances and the stability in your, you know, your work capacity, your functioning capacity, your, you know, your housing stability. Like, there's just so many aspects that it affects across all your life. So, yeah, I'm really excited about that coaching program. And I also have a couple of support groups, like, in my local area that I run, similar to, like, an AA meeting kind of set up, but just a casual get together for anyone to drop in at any time when they, you know, well, not at any time, but
yeah,
at the meeting times.
We all plan to meet together, but yeah, no, I like that idea of the casual get together is something that really helped out my recovery from bipolar disorder. And right now I'm actually not even participating in one in where I am. But when I first lived in Sacramento, I remember finding a casual meeting spot just like that. And that was such a big turnaround for me, because finally I was able to meet people that also had bipolar disorder. And prior, I just felt like this kind of weirdo in a sense. You know, you only would, I feel like I knew celebrities or something who had bipolar disorder. And so that was one of the biggest impacts for me. And that's how I first kind of started to get started turning around and, like, living a healthy life. So I guess let's give the listeners an idea of, like, when did you start to have experiences with mental health that weren't ideal? When did you start to have challenges? And when did you essentially start to get sick, in a sense?
There was definitely a significant tipping point when I was at law school. I had, like, my first manic episode there, and it was like 3 months of just not being able to sleep, being wired, not being able to sit still. Like, that was definitely, I think, the moment where my life blew up. Like, my life was never the same after that point. I was just such a straight A student, such, like, a straight, like, career-driven person. Like, I had a full scholarship to law school. Like, my life was set. And then this, like, just bomb happened, and, like, nothing was ever the same again. I often describe it as, like, you know, I was just sleeping in my bed one night, and then someone just, like, kidnapped me and put me in a helicopter and then just, like, dropped me in the middle of the ocean. You know, like, mm-hmm. just suddenly I'm, like, swimming out of my depth, and I'm like, where the hell am I? Like, what happened to me? Like, I knew that I wasn't me anymore, but, like, nobody else did. They're like, you still look the same. So trying to communicate that to other people was so difficult. And, you know, I guess when people ask me, like, what made you talk about mental illness so openly and honestly, like, it just never occurred to me not to.
Yeah.
Like, I just, like, there was just never a moment where I was like, oh, I can't talk about this. I just started, you know, talking to people about it. And I think in the beginning, you might not necessarily know that you're mentally ill. Like, you know, I just started talking about physical symptoms. Like, man, I can't sleep right now. Like, you know, I just, like, I run 4 hours a day. Like, you know, there was all of this stuff going on. And it wasn't until much, much later, I think, that I got diagnosed with a serious mental illness. I reached out to, like, GPs, to psychologists, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I was often just told, like, you know, you have depression, anxiety. It sort of coincided with perhaps a trigger or a bunch of, like, traumatic deaths that happened, you know, to some close friends and family at the time, like, 3 deaths in the space of, like, 2 weeks.
So stress did bring it on. I was exactly about to ask that. Like, so did something happen that brought on that, you know, series of events?
Yeah, like, I would say so, but also at the same time, like, looking back on my life, there was definitely a level of bipolar, you know, like these fluctuating mood episodes definitely my whole life. And if you look at, like, you know, family members, there's definitely some, you know, I would self-diagnose them with bipolar disorder. Even my grandma spent a lot of time in the psych ward, you know, before like it was a thing, okay. You know what I mean? Like
it's in the genes, as we say.
It's in the genes. And I know that like women's brains are fully developed in about 20, like 19, 20. Men, it's not until sort of like 25 when they're like fully developed.
So if at all.
If at all, that's it. But you will find that most women are triggered like, you know, late teens, early 20s, and, you know, men are sort of early 20s to like mid 20s. So, you know, like whether it was just going to happen anyway, like whether that traumatic experience particularly brought it on, whether, you know, like it was just going to happen and it just happened to coincide with that. There's like two trains of thought in the medical community as to whether it's triggered by a stressful event or just genetically at that point in time. So,
yeah, I just finished my psychiatry rotation a couple of months ago because I'm a med student here in the States. And the psychiatrist put it really beautifully, I thought. She was like, everyone, I think, is susceptible to having a psychotic break in a sense. Some people's genes make that person more susceptible or less, but everyone can, you know, have a psychotic break. And then when you add in stress, she thought, is always the motivating factor that causes some uptick of a psychotic break, whatever the stress may be. Like in my experience, I went through a breakup, and I've heard that a lot before. Grieving, I think, totally makes sense too, to kind of the instigator of when, you know, the cart gets off the track kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, 100% agree. And I think, you know, I like to break it down because I think we often have an issue where we talk about mental health or mental illness. It's like this umbrella term. And it's like, that kind of annoys me. I think that's often where the stigma comes from. And I think as a mental health advocate, you need to be really specific because our job is to really teach people how to talk about mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's, you know, it's not just like those ones that raise awareness about the stigma kind of annoy me. It's like, I don't want people to know about the stigma. I want people to know what it's really like to live with this disorder. Like I want people to know how to talk about it. And, you know, I think that's where being specific is really important. Mental health and mental illness are completely different things. Everyone will experience mental health issues in their life, just as everyone will experience physical health issues. Not everyone is going to specifically have like a mental illness. And even if they did, there are different levels of mental illness. There's like the cold version, there's the flu version, you know, and then there's something like bipolar disorder, which is maybe more along the lines of like diabetes.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a good like analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are chronic aspects to it. Some people will recover, some people will be like cured, other people like won't. You know, some people, the best they can hope for is just like a management plan.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I like to be really specific like that because you cannot compare bipolar disorder to some form of like situational depression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that was sort of what I was originally diagnosed with. Like you've just had some fucked up shit happen to you. So that's why you're not okay. And it took me like probably a good 3 years of like begging doctors and therapists for help and seeing so many different ones before I got referred to a psychiatrist who was just like, yeah, you have bipolar. Like you just scored 95 out of 100 on a bipolar diagnosis test. Like, you know, and that was kind of like the starting point. And diagnoses have like changed, been added, like been taken away like that whole time.
Yeah.
So I don't think if they really ever kind of know. And aside from like talking about a diagnosis in the sense it allows people to be specific and, you know, you might be able to relate to me, but your treatment's probably not going to be the same. Regardless of whether we have the same diagnosis or not, but that makes a huge difference. But like a diagnosis, like a label, you know how people are really against labels? They're like, why do you want to be labeled as like bipolar or whatever?
Well, one thing I think really like about your page is you show like the bad and the good kind of thing. Like there are videos of you when you're very upset and having a very difficult time, whether that's anxiety or depression, or any of the other things that you experience. And, you know, you also show the good, your artwork, your creative side, how it does fuel that. And I pull inspiration to that because I think a lot of times, although I'm very open with many things, I don't post the bad days. You know, that's just not, it's just easier not to post kind of thing. You're like, you know, I'm feeling fat today. I'm feeling down today. I don't want to post a picture of me or an inspirational quote. Like, that just doesn't feel right to me in a sense. But I need to do more of that, because I realize like that helps out people, because everyone has those days where they feel like shit and they're just really down. And so that's, I think, one of my favorite aspects of your page, is that you just really help document the whole experience. And I also like what you touched on. Like, I don't like the attitude towards stigma, like, you know, stomp out the stigma. We need to get rid of the stigma. I like to live my life like the stigma isn't there or it's not affecting me. And
absolutely,
you know, I've probably
don't talk about the stigma.
Yeah, I've had, out of the 1,000 encounters I've had with people about mental health, maybe like 1% of them has been very, very disrespectful and stigma oriented, like kind of hurtful. The vast majority of my experiences have been very, very good. So I'm like, the stigma's nothing. Like, whatever. And I think it is much healthier to live open and honest.
Absolutely. And like, it's crazy how many people I can get to be open about it. Like, it's, you know, whether it's just like some random at the bus stop, like I'll be waiting to meet a friend and then I'll just like, I don't know, strike up a conversation with like some homeless guy or like just some random on the street. And then like my friend will be like, do you even know that person? Like when they get there, I'm like, no, like we just met. We're like best friends now. Like, like I'm a really private person, but like I just talk about my mental health. Like, you know, what did you eat for breakfast? You know, like I had a bit of toast and some, you know, mild anxiety. Like it's, you know, when you talk about it like that, other people start to feel comfortable. And, you know, friends in my immediate circle or even friends that I'm not like the closest with will like seek me out to get advice or to open up about some things because they know I'm non-judgmental, but they also feel like I'm the only person that they can talk to about this. But I mean, in all honesty, that's not necessarily true, because it's like, I know that they're all going through something because they've all spoken to me about it, but they're not communicating with like each other about it. But I think that's, you know, that's where you can really make a huge difference. When people ask me that question, like how to help someone with a mental illness, I'm just like, shut the fuck up and listen. Like, that's the easiest way. Like, you don't need like millions of dollars to like change the world in this particular area. Like, you don't have to be a mental health advocate talking about it to thousands of people. Like, just speaking about it to like one person can make a huge difference. Like, smiling at someone on the street when they walk past has saved my life like many times. Like, I'd be walking my dog like in Melbourne going like, where is the next train station? Like, where am I gonna throw myself in front of a train or a tram or a bus or a truck? And then like some random person would like smile to me, and then I'm like, I'm not gonna kill myself today.
Yeah. I mean, and I do think it sounds so simple, but just being nicer and more respectful to one another goes a lot further than people think. So I want to get back to, you know, you had that kind of break in law school. And then what was the progression of you? It said it took about 3 years to kind of figure out like the diagnosis and maybe the set of meds and therapy ailments to help treat you. And then how did your life shift? Like, did you end up finishing law school or did you go right into mental health advocacy? Like, what did life look like then?
Okay, so I left law school to go to art school because I spent way too much time procrastinating at law school and creating artworks. And then even people in my law class were just like, this, like, law, you know, you're really great at it, but like, you're an amazing artist. It's like, there's many good lawyers and you're definitely like one of them, but you know, art, that there's not many people like that. So I decided to move all the way to Melbourne from the Gold Coast to go to art school. I only lasted about a semester there because I suddenly got so depressed. City life is also just not for me, but that's where I sort of got diagnosed with bipolar. Long story short, I spent a couple of years there. I ended up getting married, relatively short marriage. It was longer than Kim Kardashian's first marriage, but it was a bit of a disaster. I didn't, you know, it was just a disaster. And
it happens. It happens.
It's like a bipolar bucket list though. Like, you know what I mean? Do you have like a bipolar bucket list? Like, just stuff that you never thought you'd ever do. But like, because you're bipolar, you kind of just like tick it off the list. It's like you know, you can't do anything about it because you did it, but it's like not stuff that a sane person would ever want to do.
Yeah, I think sometimes engaging in like skiing, I sometimes think I take some stupid risks sometimes that are above my actual skiing ability. And I think that kind of adrenaline rush is very common amongst people who live with bipolar disorder. And I, you know, used to go gamble money too often, and just like spending. And I realize all those common things happen quite a bit with people with bipolar disorder. So yeah. You had this marriage that ended, and it was challenging, of course. And like, so when did the pieces in your life then start to get back together, or how did that then like all come together to the person you are today?
Well, there was still a lot, like I had a lot further to go, because you know, every time you hit rock bottom, you're like, you know, I hit rock bottom until you start free falling again. And then you're like, okay, they're like, this just seems like a bottomless pit. I'm just keep falling. So after that, I ended up moving home because I was just like, I just need to get back to somewhere familiar. I also needed to get out of that place because I wasn't safe, and I couldn't escape. So the police said to me, like, you need to get as far away from this place and him as possible. So I did that. And that was when I checked myself into the psych ward for the first time, because okay. I mean, you know, going through like a marriage breakdown is absolutely terrifying as well. Yeah. You know, like I mean, as much as like it was a disaster, you know, I loved that person. I thought that that was like my whole life. And I think, you know, you feel things so deeply, you know, having so many different filters on you, it's like at the time it feels so right. You know what I mean?
And then they say a divorce is actually more challenging emotionally to deal with than a grief. Because it is almost like a death in a sense of a marriage idea. But it's, it's like studies have shown it's extremely challenging to deal with.
Will you also grieve a change in life? It's like your whole life gets thrown upside down. And when you're, I guess, an unwell person, or you've gone through, I guess, a lot of trauma in your life, like I definitely had a codependency on that person.
Mm-hmm.
So then that's another thing. It's like, you know, that crutch is gone. It's like, I think too, I'm the type of person that gives a bunch of myself to the people around me. And when you give so much of yourself to someone else, it's like then there's nothing left when they leave, because they take everything that they gave you and more. So it's like then you're just a skeleton, like you have nothing left. And that is like, you know, like you're almost dead within yourself, like energetically, like just physically exhausted, mentally drained. So it does take a lot to recover from that. So when I went in the psych ward, you know, I checked myself into a private psych ward, because it's really hard to get into a public psych ward in Australia. But I was lucky, you know, I had private health insurance, so I could do that. And that was massively life-changing. But it was also quite, like when I got out, it was still quite triggering for me, because being back in a small town that I grew up in with my parents, they just really tried to get this control back over me, and they just caused a whole bunch of drama. So I cut them off probably again for the like 25th time in my life or something. And, you know, then I guess I got into like another shitty relationship, because that's just like what you do. And then there was a stage, like I lived in like 13 houses in like 16 months, like just share houses, just going through that like shitty situation to the next. Like I'm really good at getting jobs as well. But like I guess mental instability and fluctuating functioning capacity means that you're not that good at keeping them. You know, like in my nature is to be a reliable employee, yeah. But you just can't be when you're so sick all the time. And
certainly,
I mean, I was a sick kid. You know, like physically, I was a very sick kid. So if you look at it the same way, like if rather than like depression and bipolar disorder, I was struggling with, you know, like, I don't know, glandular fever or like chronic, like bronchitis and asthma and bronchospasms and things like that. It's like, it would be like more acceptable, but I still wouldn't be able to go to work. Like if I'm in and out of hospital, I'm being like bedridden and
yeah. So your physical and mental health sounded like it was kind of both challenging you during that time.
Absolutely. And I think instability in life in general is not good. It's like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Like, you've got this, like, you know, emotional drama in like a shitty relationship. And then, you know, you're also like coping with, say, like drugs or alcohol, and you're in and out of work. So then you got financial stress and then housing stress because you're in a shitty house that probably has like rats in it. I did live in some terrible houses. It wasn't just the people. It
was
Because that's
so the wheels were coming off. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just got like, I think, worse and worse and worse. And I was in and out of the psych ward like quite a bit. And you know, that was just kind of where my life went. I tried about 17 different medications. Like,
oh wow.
I was like seeing a GP, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, like each of them like once a week.
Okay.
You know, like plus a social worker. And I was like trying as hard as I could. Like, I was begging for help. But, you know, you're like navigating the waters of a severely inadequate, like inadequate mental health care system.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that's pretty common no matter where you are in the world. You know, I guess I have to be grateful that Australia does have like an okay one, but you sort of get stuck between the public and the private system. The public has a waiting list. I kept being told that I'm not sick enough because I wasn't getting in trouble with the police.
Wow.
Like, you know what I mean? It's like, if you're not hurting anyone else or being a public nuisance, it's like you're holding your shit together enough to like, you know, but it doesn't mean that my functioning capacity has reduced any less.
So did you have to go into the private system?
Yeah. Which is then expensive.
Yeah.
So it's like, then you're not well enough to work. So you're not well enough to be dishing out hundreds of dollars per appointments and hundreds of dollars in medications. And then you've got the whole, you're basically a lab rat too, but you're not
a trial and error approach, unfortunately, to these, whatever meds or combinations of meds. We don't have really that good of an understanding of, from a genetic standpoint, of what's going to work better. It's very, very frustrating. And sometimes even finding a therapist, it's like you got to go through a few therapists before you find someone you like. And it's a slow, gradual, frustrating process.
It's a painful process. It's hard too, because like, I think people get to a stage in your life where they're like, why aren't you better yet? And it's I thought I would be better by now too. Like, there's a time limit on, I guess, grief, and there's a time limit on like chronic and like
expectations,
illness.
Like, yeah,
you know. And it's like, people start to see it as like a personal failure. People start to see it as like, you just don't want to get better. And it's like, that hurts, because it's like, that's not who I am. Like, who would want to be like this?
Yeah,
like, it's excruciatingly painful. And it gets,
and you can maybe say that about the person who doesn't go to any appointments, doesn't take any meds, doesn't even try. And of course there are those people who just, they don't trust the system. They don't want to even try to get better, but you were going to see a doctor. You were trying the meds and doing all the right things that you're supposed to do. And it's just like, I'm not getting better. And that is a tough reality, but it's just, like for the stats of antidepressants, it's like 55% of people actually feel better. The other 45% don't really feel that much better. And we don't have a ton of other great solutions. So when did you kind of start to make a turn towards the better? Like, did you finally start to find the right combination of meds, the therapist you liked? Like, how did you come today where you can be this kind of inspiration for other people living with mental illness?
Well, definitely finding the right doctors made a huge difference. Like, in, for those of you listening in Australia, there's Headspace Australia is a great youth, mental health, but also health organization. So they offer like free services to youth, and you can get frequent appointments. You can get heaps of support in so many different areas. And they sort of saved my life in the sense that that was the first time that I could consistently get healthcare. And it was also the first time that like I sat in an office and the doctor was like, we'll figure this out.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm kind
of, maybe the confidence. Yeah.
Hang on. For some reason, these headphones have like stopped working.
Oh man. Can you hear me? Testing, testing.
Yeah. I can hear you, but you're just coming out of a completely different speaker. Hang on. Okay, you're back in the headphones.
Okay, there we go.
Sorry about that.
So, yeah, when did you start, like, figuring, you saw that you were using that program, you saw doctors that you finally liked, and it sounds like you got on meds that were starting to really make you feel better, and then did you, you know, start to find work that you found appropriate, or like, kind of, how did you get back on your feet, sort of thing?
Yeah, well, it's like, I think one point that I do want to make is, as far as like finding the right meds and stuff, like, it's not just a long process, but it's also like difficult. Like, recovery is like a puzzle piece, like a giant puzzle. And like, you might find one piece, but then you find another issue. So I actually have like multiple kind of diagnoses. So like, it got to the point where my bipolar was stable, but I was still experiencing massive mood swings and all sorts of different things. And that's when I found out, you know, I guess I had like premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which is a mood disorder that women get. It's quite common with women with bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And it's like a sensitivity to progesterone. So every week, or like 7 to 10 days before my period, I would become suicidal, homicidal, mm-hmm. Extremely fatigued, like just depressed. Like, it was just, it was shit. I get migraines too, like, yeah, chronic migraines. So, you know, that was like another thing that I had to figure out, like, once I figured out the bipolar puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like, you get another diagnosis. It's like one thing kind of just starts to dissipate when you deal with that. And then there's something else. You're like, okay, now I need to start dealing with that one, diagnosing that. Now finding new meds to treat that aspect of it. And then having those those conversations with doctors who are like, we're not putting you on antidepressants because you're bipolar, so you're only on mood stabilizers and antipsychotics. But without antidepressants, the PMDD was not going to be cured, and the borderline personality disorder was not going to be helped. So, you know, like, there's that conversations, those arguments you have to have with doctors. Like, you have to be your own advocate as well.
Yeah, that's really true.
Yeah. And then mood charting made a huge difference with that, because that's where I could start to see these patterns. And that's where I could really start to convince my doctors, like, see, like, this is what's going on with me. Because they often didn't, I guess, believe me as well. But that was, I guess, a huge turning point as far as recovery was concerned. At this point, I'm like 7 years in. I'm still kind of like going through employment, unemployment, like that sort of thing. Okay. I did find, you know, I'm not one to like not work. So I did have a bunch of friends that run their own businesses. So they would like help me out. One of my friends was a dog trainer. She did doggy daycare. She'd hire me to help her out. Another one was like a racehorse trainer. So she'd get me to clean out stables. Someone sold like jewelry at the markets. So they'd, you know, so I kept myself kind of busy, but it was clear that a 9-to-5 was not going to work for me. One, because I needed to attend too many doctor's appointments. So working full time meant that I couldn't go to any of my doctor's appointments, which then meant my mental health would deteriorate. Also because like, I was still spending about 3 months of the year in the psych ward.
Okay.
So that's just like not really going to work in many aspects. And I guess it got to the point where when I started like talking about it online, they sort of put pressure on my parents, like public shaming, because they like never really wanted to help me. And it got
wait,
to a
who
point,
put pressure on your parents?
My parents' friends.
Oh, okay.
They started being like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, your daughter is struggling, and why are you not doing anything about it? Like, you're in a position to support her, and the least you could do is like give her a place to live in one of your granny flats so that she's not constantly moving, worrying about being homeless. Like, she needs some stability, and you can do that. And I think my psychiatrist even called my parents and was just like, hey, seriously, like, you're just like, you know, you're just causing way more issues.
Well, and sometimes the approach, I feel like, to mental illness can't always be solved with a therapist and psychiatrist. It's really family dynamics. And it's a lot of people object to that. And it is, you know, definitely though part of the equation. Like, everything does have to be factored in, and family dynamics and just how people communicate and teach each other, affect each other, interact with one another.
And I think too, like, you know, I guess a massive turning point was being able to be in that stable environment where I didn't have to worry. Well, they tried to kick me out all the time, but it was like, you know, it's just kind of like, okay, like get the police to remove me because I'm not going anywhere. Like, you know, you can do that, I think, with like your parents. But you know, having, you know, the other way you can help someone with a mental illness other than, you know, being there for them and talking about it is to help them in really practical ways. Like if I can't get to my doctor's appointment because I lost my license drink driving, you know, like offer to drive me, like offer to make that appointment if I can't make the phone call myself, or if I haven't eaten because I can't cook my meals or I can't go to the supermarket or I can't afford to eat right, you know, like bring over some frozen meals, you know, come over and like maybe help me clean up my apartment or my space. Like, I mean, it's not your responsibility, but if you want to help a friend who is like really struggling, like those are some things that can make a huge difference to them.
Yeah.
Because
sometimes depression, I feel like it, sometimes people interpret depression as laziness. Like, oh, they're just being lazy. They're not cleaning their room or even showering. You know, I feel like that's very common with people who are in severe depression, but it's like that really is a symptom. It's weird to think of it that way, but it's a symptom of depression. Like they don't have the energy or motivation because their brain just simply isn't working necessarily properly.
But absolutely. And it's like it's like you just don't care enough. Like it's just hard. Like I just had a migraine for a week and my room is in a terrible state. I mean, I've cleaned up this bit, but my kitchen, all my dishes are dirty. Like they've been sitting on my sink for like a week now. But you know, I will get back and clean that up because I have more periods of wellness than I did previously. But, you know, my mom said to me once, like, I told her that I was going to go into the psych ward. And she's like, why? I thought you were doing really well. And I was like, no, I've been absolutely terrible. And I was like, okay, let me tell you the reasons that I've been terrible and the reasons you should know that I've been terrible. One, the curtains have been drawn in my room. So like, it's just been a dark little den. I'm like, my room is terribly messy. I haven't gotten out of my like pajamas in like weeks. There's like a billion coffee cups outside in the cigarette smoking area where I'm constantly smoking cigarettes. You know, like I haven't walked my dog. Like I haven't brushed my hair. Like there are so many things that are, you know, that are going on. And she's like, yeah, but you're always messy. Like you're always like that. And I'm like, isn't that the saddest part? That you think that I've been depressed for the majority of my life, that you think this is my personality.
Yeah. That's, I don't know. It's tough.
Yeah. And also the fact, like people talk about mental illness being invisible. It's not. I mean, every single day she told me, you need to clean up your room. You're a messy bitch. Like, why are you in your pajamas? Like, you need to get dressed. Like, you know, clean up these coffee cups. I'm sick of them, like, being outside on the table out here. Like, you know, like, brush your hair. It looks disgusting. Like, you haven't washed your hair. Like, I'm like, you have pointed out all of these symptoms.
Yeah, it's really true. So how did you turn into this person that people look up to for inspiration with mental health? And when did you kind of start being more of an advocate kind of thing online, public speaking, as you talked about, and, you know, eventually this coaching that you're doing and helping people out all over?
So this starts off as a bit of a funny story. So I broke up with my boyfriend who happened to be like a bodybuilder. And he was all like really vain online posting pictures of himself. And I happened to be like super manic at the time. And because I like when I go through trauma, it tends to trigger like a manic episode. So I was like ridiculously manic. And I was like living with this friend in a derelict house. And we were both just so broke. I was unemployed. And she's just like, I don't know how you can be like unemployed, like, you know, or as in broke. She's like, you're hot. She's like, why don't you just become like Instagram famous? Like one of those, like, you know, chicks on Instagram. So in my manic state, I'm like, this is a great idea to get revenge on my ex-boyfriend. I can just post like, you know, probably some like, I don't want to say X-rated, but some like like raunchy photos of myself online, get a bunch of followers and then start like selling products. And then I can just be like rich and whatever. That's the logic in my manic mind. Right.
Yeah.
And
maybe not the most clear. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm going through that process and then I started to just like feel like the pictures that I'd already pre-taken and were posting were just not replicative of like my mood as I started to like come down, and I started to feel really inauthentic and just like, that's not the type of person that I am. That's manic me. So I started just like writing it, like just for kind of the fun of it. Like I'd post the picture, but then I'd just be like, I'm feeling so fucking shit today. And it would sort of turn into these kind of like little poetic, like things, I don't know, just compulsively.
So kind of blogging. Yeah.
Yeah. And they just sort of got like longer and longer. And then there sort of became this state where people started saying, you know, we follow you for what you write, not for like the photos that you post. In fact, the photos that you post actually make us like want to like unfollow you. It's like, we prefer your writing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, really the community that I started to gather in Instagram actually like put me on this path. Like they were actually the ones that started this like whole thing basically, because like with their encouragement, I started to like, you know, started to focus more on the writing aspect and sort of go down that path. And
and they get a more like genuine follower kind of base. Yeah. For
exactly. You know,
good reasons kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of like, as I came down from this episode, that really kind of more realigned, I think, with me and like who I am as a person, because I really feel vulnerable and don't like being like that shiny, I guess, manic, like,
yeah,
whatever, like we'll call it. But I guess that's where it came into like the reason I called myself Bipolar Barbie, because my room again was a mess. Like manic me had just exploded everywhere, and my housemate's like, oh my god, your room is a mess. And she was like, I don't think you would be that messy if you didn't have as many clothes, because I had a lot of clothes. And I was kind of like, yeah, but like I need, like each version of me has like a different personality, like each personality needs their own wardrobe. And I'm not talking about like split personality disorder, but more like, you know, manic me likes to be colorful and bright and sexy, and depressed me is like, I just want to have baggy clothes and tracky pants. And, you know, I want to be like all grunge and like black and just, you know, like I had all of these different versions. And then I kind of realized like I was exactly like a Barbie doll. Like I was writing this chapter in my book and I was thinking, you know, Barbie has these outfits, like she's roller skating Barbie, she's nurse Barbie, like she's scuba diving Barbie, she's Malibu Barbie, like Barbie can be 1,000 different people. And then I was kind of like, I'm like a Barbie doll, like I'm like manic Barbie and suicidal Barbie and anxious Barbie and depressed Barbie and like any mixture of them in between. And I was like, I feel sorry for Barbie because she doesn't get to decide who she wants to be every day. Some little girl decides that. And I felt exactly the same. I was like, I don't get to decide, like at the time, who I get to be every day. Like I just wake up and half the battle is figuring out like, okay, well, like, what are you going to be today? Like, you're going to be manic. You're going to be, you know, like what are you going to be? And so that's where the name Bipolar Barbie came from. And I think how it evolved from just kind of blogging on Instagram to where it is today is funny, because I was in the psych ward again after that. And my psychiatrist said to me, like, you need to stop focusing on what you've lost and start focusing on what you've gained. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, what could mental illness have given me? Like, this is ridiculous. And I was thinking about it that night. And I was thinking about, like, all the stuff that I felt like I'd lost my idea of marriage, of, like, financial gain, of, like, my law degree. Like, I'd lost this idea of what my future would be. But I kind of thought, like, who created that picture? Like, was that my life plan or was that someone else's life plan? And I looked back, like when I was a little kid, I had the biggest dreams. Like when I was a little kid, I wanted to be a motivational speaker. I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be like a fashion designer. I wanted to publish a book and I wanted to change the world. Those were like my five dreams, aside from wanting to be a pop star, which is just probably become like unachievable. I can't sing, so that was like a pipe dream. But yeah, these five things is really what I wanted. And then I was like, wow, I've kind of gotten everything that I ever wanted because of this journey. Like I've come full circle back to, I'm looking at publishing a book, I'm giving motivational speeches, I'm, you know, like I'm writing, I'm, my art is better because of my mental illness, like I'm connecting with people, I've gotten back into like kind of fashion design type stuff.
Yeah. And
you know, like I'm changing the world. People tell me every day that I'm changing the world.
And you're like, developing like a community through your local community meetups and your online ones. So, you know, how do people learn more about this coaching program that you offer and like getting in touch with you, following you?
Yeah. So I guess the easiest way is probably to remember bipolarbarbie.com. If you can remember bipolarbarbie.com, that's my website. You can find links there to everything, to like my mastermind program. You can find links to like my social media, my YouTube channel, all that sort of thing. Or if you just Google Bipolar Barbie, you know, the first searches is all my social media.
And it's mostly women you said you work with. Or all women?
Well, no. I work with everyone. I work with males and females. The support group currently that I have online, the coaching group, is predominantly, well, it is women at the moment. That's just because they were like, I only had one man that I guess applied to be part of the group. Okay. And, you know, then they kind of, that person was like, oh, I just can't afford it right now. I just have other priorities. So I kind of made it women. And then I thought like these women are quite vulnerable and I wanted it to be exclusively women, but yeah, I am looking
and
at
I think
starting.
That's very therapeutic at times. Definitely.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think there's just a lot of stuff with the male, female, like in the world at the moment. And I'm connecting with a really feminine energy, which I think is me shifting from that masculine, like hiding behind this logic and this masculine persona. And now I'm getting more in touch with my feelings. And that's a really feminine kind of vibe that I'm putting out. But I'm also looking at starting a male version of the mastermind. So if you're a man, like definitely, you know, you can be a part of it. I guess what's involved in that process, I'm really excited. There's a Facebook group, which is like where we journal daily. We look at our top priorities. We celebrate our wins. And whether your top priorities be like, I'm going to do 10 hours of book editing today, or it's like, I'm going to take a shower. I'm going to make a phone call. Like I'm going to, I don't know, eat something more than 2 minute noodles. Like that is some of the people's priorities in there. But every day that changes too. Like some days that's my priority. Like if that's all like I can do. So there's that aspect. There's also like a weekly group support call that we have where everyone gets together. We chat a little bit, we celebrate like and review our previous week. We set up some priorities for the week ahead. Monthly, those calls are also going to be like a bit longer and I get a guest speaker in.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah. So at the moment I've got like 3 women lined up for the next 3 months, like that have been role models to me, that are from all different aspects of life, that have taught me some amazing life skills, supported me in major ways, and I think have a lot to share. And I also have some male like versions of them. So if I did have a masculine group, I'd love to get some really strong, inspiring men in there as well. Whether or not I'll join the male female groups at some point, I don't know. I feel bad segregating them, but I also feel like it's just a good thing at the moment in such a vulnerable space. But you also get like a monthly call with me where it's like a one-on-one call, like Skype, like this chat. And we just look, like we reflect, we work out kind of what your priorities are and maybe what are the 1 to 3 things that you could do right now over the next month, like every day, that would have a massive impact on your life. Like what are the habits that we can create? And what are the goals that we are looking at so that you can be the best version of yourself? Because that's all I want for everyone. So
yeah,
that's, you know, that's awesome. There's a bunch of different kind of like price schedules. I am charging a very like cheap rate for this. I think like for the full program, it was like $100 a month, which, you know, I don't think is that bad for the amount of value that you get. There were some cheaper options if you didn't want like as much kind of one-on-one time. You just wanted the more like journaling and sort of like the group chats and stuff like that.
Yeah. And it's a just real interesting alternative to the kind of, you know, when we are in clinic now and we have someone with depression or any kind of issue, you know, it's go see a psychiatrist if needed. And go find a therapist. And, you know, if you think about it, the cost of a therapist with copays, whatever, probably pretty comparable to the program you're offering. And it's just a very different approach, but could be very effective approach too for these women and men as well, of course, like you were saying. So I think it's a very innovative, creative solution that you're offering. And I hope, And I know people are finding value in it. So I hope some of our listeners definitely enjoyed it. And that's coming up on about an hour of us chatting. And I think the audience really got a good idea of your experiences. And I hope some of them feel encouraged to join your program, because I think you're offering really a cool service. And it's women all over the world, right? You must pull from...
Yeah, so it's people from like all over the world, which is amazing, and they're just, it's so supportive. Like it's just great. And as you were saying, it's not intended to replace therapy or medical treatment, but at the same time, it's like it's daily support. Like I comment on your journals, I read through your journals, I'm there to be messaged sort of like at any time for anyone in the program. So it's like if you need that support, I am going to be there for you. And I think one program that I did in the past was to have like a personal helper that came to my house like once a week. And they really helped me get my finances in order and get, you know, those like bills sorted out and to come up with a plan of how I was going to get my life back on track with those like everyday kind of tasks. So I think that's like the missing piece of the puzzle for lots of people. And it's really exciting to switch from that like mass content creation to really support people in a one-on-one environment and, yeah, you know, make massive changes to people's lives.
Yeah. But you still are posting, you know, videos and stuff. Oh, yeah. and cool blogs. So I still follow you. So I hope the listeners do too. Well, thank you, Jess, so much for coming on, talking to me all the way from Australia. My first real YouTube podcast like this, with an actual camera. So this is going to be really fun. And yeah, thanks again. I really, really appreciate you coming on, and I want to have you back on it on another episode.
Yeah, definitely. I would absolutely love that. So I guess on that note, like if you guys have any questions, definitely get in contact with one of us, from this podcast. And then if we do another one, we can answer some of those questions.
That would be awesome. Yeah. I think that's a great idea.
Awesome. All right. Well, cool. Thank you so much.
Have a nice
guys.
Weekend. Take it easy.
You too.
Geico asks, how would you love a chance to save some money on insurance? Of course you would. And when it comes to great rates on insurance, Geico can help. Like with insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, and RV. Even help with homeowners or renters coverage. Plus, add an easy-to-use mobile app, available 24-hour roadside assistance and more, and Geico is an easy choice. Switch today and see all the ways you could save. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com or contact your local agent today.
Join Tubi in celebrating Black History Month with the largest free collection of black cinema streaming every day of the year, including exclusive Tubi originals, Howard High, and Pass the Mic. Tubi, watch free.